Hampshire Public Radio News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The clucking of hens is being heard more in the Granite State lately, even in suburban and urban areas. But the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services had some concerning news yesterday for those in this burgeoning backyard chicken movement. 11 Granite Staters between March and July were sickened by poultry-borne salmonella, most of them raising chickens at home. The illnesses were linked to a broader multi-state outbreak traced a few years ago to an Ohio hatchery. The good news, all of the people who got sick here recovered, but the moral of the story is, according to DHHS, wash your hands after handling anything poultry-related, from cleaning out the coop to collecting those lovely fresh eggs. Today in The Exchange, the ins and outs of backyard chicken farming. Later in the hour, another hot backyard topic, compost, what we can and can't throw into that heap. But as we start out with backyard chicken farming, let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. And by the way, lots of listeners posted pictures of their chickens on our Facebook page. You can check them out there. It's NHPR Exchange, all one word, or head to our website, nhpr.org. Our guest for our chicken segment this morning is Dot Perkins. She's a field specialist and member of the dairy, livestock, and poultry team for UNH Cooperative Extension out of the Merrimack County office in Boscawen. And Dot, it's great to meet you. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Well, Dot, we hear over and over again about this big increase in backyard chickens here in New Hampshire and in other New England states. What are you seeing?
Oh, boy. People have been excited about chickens for about 5 or 6 years now. I started doing talks about how to take care of chickens about that long ago. And without exaggeration, I do maybe 5 or 6 a year. And there's at least 60 or 70 people at each talk. And when I ask how many people already have chickens, the majority of them don't. So I keep wondering where all these people are coming from. There's so many of them. So it's gotten quite exciting.
It's big.
Yeah.
You were telling me before the show that you almost can't even go shopping anymore because people just come up to you and say, Dot, help me with my chickens.
It's true. I'm the chicken lady, which is my brother and sisters would find that amusing. But I go to the grocery store or the fair or out to dinner or any place. And inevitably, somebody comes up to me and starts asking me questions about their chickens and, you know, and it happens all the time.
How does this compare to, you know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago?
Well, 10 years ago, not too many people had chickens. You know, there were a few here and there, but people were not so interested in producing their own food. And then, of course, we've had a lot of scares. You know, I call it the CNN effect, where we've had a lot of scares. People hear about the salmonella outbreak and tomatoes being contaminated or peanut butter and have you. And slowly but surely, people have become more aware of what they consider healthy. They've become more aware of how animals are being kept and making conscious decisions about how they want their food raised. It's certainly not cheaper to raise your own eggs.
Really?
Yes.
Because that's the impression is, hey, I just got in the backyard and get them. That's great.
Yeah. If you add everything up, you know, the amount to buy the chick, the amount to raise the chicken to the age of laying, which is 21 weeks, and then you keep it for a year's worth of production, you're going to get maybe 200 to 275 eggs a year, depending on your management practices. And, you know, all the work involved, I know we don't normally think about our time as costing us. So if we don't count our time and we don't put insurance for selling eggs, I mean, on your homeowner's policy, somebody buys eggs from you, you know, you're liable for anything that's wrong with those eggs.
Wow.
So, I mean, these are not things that people think about, but I suppose if you didn't count any of those things, and you should, an economic person would tell you you should, they probably cost you about $3.50 a dozen. If you look on the sides of the road, most people sell their eggs for about $2.50 a dozen. And that's conventionally raised. If you go organic, the price doubles because organic grain is twice the amount as conventional grain.
So people are doing it not so much to save money, but boy, those fresh eggs are good. Also, they're concerned about factory farming. They want to be more connected with their food, the whole local food movement. That's what's going on here, Doug.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
So who should and who should not keep chickens?
You know, people keep pigeons on the roof. You can keep chickens or just birds. The difference between chickens and everything else is that we call them livestock and we eat the chicken or we eat their eggs. So that makes them livestock. And I know people who have two chickens. You figure a chicken lays an egg every 25 hours. So if you only eat three eggs a day, you know, you only need three or four chickens. That's not a lot of chickens. And they can be kept in a small spot. So keeping them in the city in a backyard is not an issue. I don't think it's an issue. It's an issue with your neighbors. It's an issue if you don't keep them clean. It's an issue if you have a rooster. You know, you're not doing anything for manure management. So there are things involved with keeping them or any other animal in the backyard. If you've got 15 dogs in a 10 by 10 spot, it's not good. But if you've got one, it's probably going to be all right. So it's the same thing with any animal that you're keeping in a small space. You got to be aware of, you know, those animals' needs, and zoning and things of that nature all have to be met. But, you know, you need to be prepared to take care of them 365 days a year. So if somebody's going to take off, you know, you can't just leave the chickens for a week or two. People do have other people take care of them for them. But, you know, nobody takes care of your animals the way you do. Nobody knows them the way you do. They wouldn't notice if there was something, a problem with them. Do you have a vet? Are you willing to pay a vet for your chicken? It costs you $5 to have the chicken. You're going to pay $50 to walk through a vet's door? I mean, you know, there's lots of questions to be answered as far as whether you should or shouldn't have
chicken.
That's
interesting. So somebody who works 15 hours a day, probably not. Somebody who likes to go on big, long trips, probably not. Somebody of limited income who doesn't want to pay those veterinary bills, probably not.
Correct. Correct. But certainly all those people who probably shouldn't, there are plenty of people around who are raising them and are more than happy to sell their eggs to them.
Let me invite our listeners to join us, Dot, and they have a whole bunch of questions for you. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, we're looking at this rising backyard chicken movement here in the Granite State. As we're hearing from our guest, Dot Perkins, it's big to the point where she can barely go grocery shopping these days without being asked about chickens. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And if you want to see some lovely pictures of chickens that our listeners have posted, go to our Facebook page, nhpr.org, or our website, nhpr.org. Here's an email that came in yesterday, Dot, from Pam in Marlborough. She says, I hope you touch on the fact that over 100 bears have been killed already this year, many involved with predations on backyard chickens and chicken feed. So I want to ask you about that. But she also says, on a lighter note, there was a book on backyard chickens that suggested not to give them names unless you choose names like fricassee and cacciatore. So she's touching on this idea that some people who raise backyard chickens get attached to them. And once they stop laying eggs, they don't want to kill them and eat them.
Very common.
Henopause. They go into henopause. They're not laying eggs.
Yeah.
And the owner says, what do I do? I love Henrietta.
So we don't know exactly how long chickens lay eggs, but we do know that the egg production drops off after 2 years. And so in commercial places, the birds go into the freezer, if you will, get turned into dog food, baby food, that sort of thing. The meat does. And they replace the flock. In the backyard, not so much. People love their chickens, and they all have names, a good many of them, especially if you've only got two or three or four because, you know, you didn't need a million eggs. And they can live to be 10 years old or older. I've had a few chickens that have been very old. They call me up all the time, what can I do with this chicken? I mean,
it stopped laying.
They
what
stopped
do I do?
Laying. Yeah, and years ago, you know, those were called spent hens. And you could buy them in the grocery store for that matter, and you made soup out of them. You know, they didn't lay anymore, and so then you replaced them with other chickens so that you had a constant supply of eggs. And
because people weren't attached to their chickens.
They weren't attached.
They were
on farms. Livestock.
And, yeah.
Right, right.
So what do people do now?
They give them away to people. They keep them.
They keep them even though they're not
laying
eggs.
They keep them even though they're not laying eggs.
Well, you keep your dog or cat around.
Right, exactly. They treat them like pets, and that's kind of what happens.
What do you do?
Every year I put two or three chickens in the in the freezer and turn them into soup. And every year I hatch out baby chickens or buy some new baby chickens and replace those hens with new pullets so that I have a constant supply of eggs and chicken soup during flu season. But I was raised around chickens, and so it doesn't bother me. It was always just a fact of life. We played with the chickens when we were kids, and then in the fall, all the chickens went in the freezer. So, you know, it was just a fact of life. The majority of people didn't grow up like I did. So,
let's take some calls from our listeners. Lots of emails, too, and some Facebook comments. The number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Christine's calling from Keene. Hi, Christine. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for calling. I have heard that I got chickens, and I decided to have some, and they slept in my bed. They were tiny and cold, and I raised them just a few, and they're down to one now, and she's the pet.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. You know, this is the whole pet issue. Christine very much feeling attached to her chickens, Dot, to the point where they're in her bed. Have you heard of things like this?
I have had some people that have kept chickens in their apartments and wanted to know how to manage the manure in their apartments because you can't litter box train a chicken.
Oh, dear.
And so that can be a problem. It can cause illness.
Is that legal to have a chicken in your house?
To have it in your house, your zone, if you're living in an apartment, I doubt that, the zoning says that you can have livestock in the house. It's an individual town thing. So, you know, there are some strange laws and rules on the books that, you know, could still be, but...
Well, perfect segue to what's coming up, because after a short break, we're going to talk to a land use lawyer about how towns and cities are dealing with the rise in interest in backyard chicken farming. So stay with us for that and join us 1-800-892-6477.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio 919. Good morning. Congratulations to Kenneth and Sarah Kimball of Jackson, New Hampshire. They're the grand prize winners of the 2014 NHPR Summer Car Raffle. Our other winners are posted at nhpr.org. In the meantime, thanks to everyone who purchased raffle tickets and support public radio in New Hampshire. We have a flash flood watch in effect through this evening for most of the state. Cloudy showers and a chance of thunderstorms today. Some locally heavy rainfall possible. High temperatures in the upper 60s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Bernstein Shores Education Law Group, providing sound legal counsel to New Hampshire's public and private educational institutions in Manchester and at bernsteinshore.com. And Crotchet Mountain School in Greenfield, nurturing growth, learning, sharing, and the singular joy of achievement for students with special needs, crotchetmountain.org. It's 9:20. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the backyard chicken trend in the Granite State. Let's hear your stories about raising chickens out back or how you feel about the hens next door. Give us a call, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. Dot Perkins is our guest, field specialist, and a member of the Dairy, Livestock, and Poultry Team for UNH Cooperative Extension. And just before the break, we were talking about zoning rules and how they regard this rise in backyard chicken farming. Joining us now with more on that is Jason Reimers. He's a land use lawyer for BCM Environmental and Land Law. Jason, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
So how does this work, Jason? Does the state have rules about who can and can't have backyard chickens, or is it more town by town?
It's town by town. And in the last few years, a lot of towns, especially New Hampshire cities, have been amending their zoning ordinances or tweaking them to either allow them or not allow them, or to set rules, for what can be allowed.
So, what trend have you seen? Are you seeing more towns allowing them, or more towns saying no, we don't really want this?
Definitely seeing more towns allowing them. You know, as Dot said, she's seeing a huge increase in people who want chickens, and I think that the zoning ordinances reflect that.
And how are towns having to tweak their ordinances, as you said, Jason? In what way?
Well, Concord, in the last few years, changed their ordinance, and now you can have up to five hens on a lot that's less than an acre in size. They have, both Concord and Manchester have rules as part of the zoning ordinances about what you need to do with the manure, how far chicken coops can be set, must be set back from property lines. They don't allow generally the free roaming of chickens. And keep in mind, I'm talking about the cities. When you get out to more rural towns, it's likely that the zoning ordinance doesn't even address chickens at all.
So is that pretty typical, Concord's ordinance, for a city or a heavily populated suburban area? You know, five hens, certain rules about setbacks, certain rules about no roosters and so forth. Is that pretty typical?
I think that it is typical, although the cities do vary as far as some of the particulars, but the overall structure of it in how what is addressed is typical. You know, Concord, you could have up to five hens, and you could have them on a less than 1 acre lot, but, you know, Manchester approaches it a little differently, requires 1 acre and one chicken on that acre, and then if you want more chickens, you have to have at least a quarter acre per additional chicken. And Manchester allows roosters, whereas Concord doesn't. But what I've seen, all the cities tend to address the same, you know, array of issues.
Here's an email that has to do with zoning for chickens in Goffstown. I'd love to share this with you, Jason, and get your thoughts. This is from Adam in Goffstown. Adam, thank you. He says, a couple of years ago, we decided to get chickens. In Goffstown at the time, there was a restriction where chickens would be allowed, only by special exception through the zoning board. The town planning department was certainly helpful. It seems almost every zoning board meeting in the spring and summer had at least one of these, quote, chicken hearings. Cost $125 to apply and notify abutters. We made flyers, gave them to each of our neighbors. We had one neighbor with concerns, which were heard, but it didn't stop us from getting our hens. Instead, we figured out a way to keep him happy and make sure we spoke about any potential problems. In the end, Adam says, a sensible plan where we have our chickens on a rolling coop called a chicken tractor, and the fact that we don't have dozens of chickens, we have five, or a rooster helped ease any worries. And Adam says, this past spring, the town even voted to loosen the restrictions on having chickens. So what do you think about this story, Jason? Here's Adam trying to, you know, work it out without it getting too difficult.
Yeah. Well, I live in Goffstown.
Oh,
and,
okay.
He sounds like a good neighbor. Any time that you need a special exception or a variance or you need something from the zoning board that a neighbor or all of your abutting neighbors might not be happy about, I think you should do exactly what Adam did. Approach your neighbors and see if you can work out any potential problems they will have, rather than have your neighbors come to the zoning hearing and, you know, and deal with it there. So I like Adam's approach, and that's a good idea, for sure.
Jason, last question for you, if I could, please. What should folks consider before they, you know, go to that mail order company and pick up a dozen chicks? What should they be thinking about from your land use perspective?
Before they order the chicks, I would look at the zoning ordinance and determine whether you can have chickens on your property. You know, that's the first question. Are they allowed? Like I said, a lot of towns' ordinances don't address chickens. Once you determine whether they're allowed, then you need to figure out whether you need a chicken coop or not. Whether you can have them free roaming or not, all those kinds of questions, I think that you should have answers to and the necessary, you know, structures in place before your chickens arrive.
Okay. Jason, good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Laura.
Jason Reimers, land use lawyer for BCM Environmental and Land Law, talking about some of the zoning requirements and things to think about before you go into becoming a backyard chicken farmer. Your questions and comments are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. We want your stories about your backyard chickens or the hens next door. How do you feel about that? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. All one word. And there's some lovely pictures of chickens that our listeners have already posted there. So check them out. Dot Perkins, I'd love to get your thoughts, too, on this whole zoning, land use. How aware do you think most people are of the restrictions, the limitations when they go into this?
It's not unusual for people to acquire livestock before they're prepared for the livestock, whether the housing is adequate or not. It's easier to get animals than it is to get rid of them, and zoning is not something they often think about, especially if they live out in the country type of a thing. They figure if they have 5 acres of land, but there could be protective covenants on that land that says no chickens. People do things like that sometimes when they convey land. So it's important to know whether or not you can have them or not. And I don't think that people think it through really well.
Even in the live free or die state, there's some restrictions on chickens
and what you can have.
Yeah, well, they are livestock. They are birds. Yeah. Do you ever hear the other side of this? You know, I know you hear from a lot of enthusiasts. Do you ever hear from people who are, you know, who don't have chickens and are worried about avian diseases? We hear about bird flu and, you know, there was the salmonella outbreaks. Do you get complaints from people about that?
No, people don't call me with things like that. They, with the exception of animal rights people who are concerned about the processing of meat birds and that sort of thing, I can't say that I've gotten any calls.
All right, let's go back to our callers. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Wendy joins us from Merrimack. Hi, Wendy. Go ahead. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a flock. I've had it for about 5 years, and I write about chickens. I write about them on my blog, and I write for magazines like Mother Earth News and Backyard Poultry. And what I'm seeing is that there's a huge chicken community out there. I mean, people love their chickens. And I've written articles about how people dress their chickens in costumes and how they diaper them and how they keep them indoors. It's really amazing. We actually had a chicken live in our house for 6 months, but that's just because she was injured and we had to protect her. But one of the problems I'm seeing is that people love their chickens so much, they're medicating their chickens. And because they're considered livestock, they're not allowed to have certain medications. And so that's one of the problems that I'm seeing in backyard flocks.
Medications like what?
Well, like antibiotics. So what they'll do is if a chicken is injured, you know, they'll try some of the antibiotics that they might have in their house, and you know, they sort of try to self-treat.
So they don't take it to the vet; they try and do it themselves.
That's correct, because what that said is, you know, a $5 chicken, you know, you take it to the vet, it could easily, you know, run you $100 or more. You know,
what do you think about people keeping chickens in their homes, Wendy? We heard earlier from a caller who, you know, loved her chicken so much that she had it in her bed.
You know, chicken, and this is one of the things that's surprising about chickens, is people find out that they're lovely, lovely animals. And some of them, I mean, depending on the breed and the genetics, they're really very affectionate. I had one chicken, when I would go outside and call her, she would run over to me, jump in my lap, and fall asleep. You know, she was like a puppy. So some people get very attached. But the thing is, and Dot mentioned this, you can't house train a chicken. I tried to. You can't do it. They do sell diapers for chickens if you're really devoted. We weren't quite as devoted as that. So after 6 months, we put our chicken in the coop.
All right. Wendy, thank you very much for calling in. Very interesting stuff.
Thank you.
Did you want to jump in, Dot?
Medications, knowing what you're giving animals is very important, livestock animals, because if you're eating those eggs or the meat from those birds,
Sure. There's
something on every bottle of medication that's called withholding, which means the amount of time it takes for that medication to leave the animal's system or not be found in their products like the milk or the eggs. And nothing is sent to be processed in the United States that has been medicated, that the withholding time hasn't been adhered to. And so it's very important that the medication, first of all, be rated for chickens, because those indications, the withholding indications, have been tested on certain animals. If it's not rated for a chicken, like penicillin or something like that, you know, you could easily be contaminating the food.
Well, I'm glad she called, because this is something I completely had not thought about. So if you give your chicken, you know, some antibiotic or some other medication that you have laying around the house because you don't feel like spending the money at the vet, you could end up consuming that medication yourself in the eggs.
Or even selling those eggs to somebody who's allergic to penicillin, and what if it's in the egg and that person has an anaphylactic shock because of it? So
okay, well,
it's
Wendy,
very important.
Glad you called, Wendy. Thank you very much. And let's go to Monica in Penacook. Hi, Monica. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I'm glad you have this subject online. I have a question regarding how old, I mean, my chickens, I had them about 12 years ago. I had to move, so I gave them to my mother. She grew up on a farm, so she was accustomed to taking care of chickens, no big deal. But, you know, my chickens laid for at least 2-3 years. There was one that wasn't laying, but I couldn't nail who it was that was not laying. So she coexisted, no problem. They're lovely little creatures. But how long can I go, because I plan on getting some more, and still eat the chicken? How old is too old for a chicken?
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling in, Monica.
Well, it depends on what you want to do with the meat. So the younger the bird and the less muscular it is, the tender the meat is going to be. So we don't usually – so a young chicken would be okay for frying or baking the bird. But as they get older, they get tougher, and so that's why we usually turn them into stew, because it's something that you cook for a long time and it makes the meat tender. So their age really doesn't have, like a 10-year-old chicken would be just as good for soup as a 4-year-old chicken.
And what do you do with yours?
I turn them into chicken soup.
Yeah.
And then I freeze it and pull some out when I have the flu or something and I need
sustenance.
Nourishments and sustenance, that's right.
You know, I read a very funny article, actually, about people who couldn't stand to, you know, as you put it, Dot, send their chickens to the freezer, so that there are companies now that market themselves to people whose hens have stopped laying, and they say, look, we'll take them away for you. We'll do the nasty work. We'll package them up nice and pretty, just like they have at the grocery store, and we'll deliver it back to you. Seems like a growth industry.
You know, anytime something becomes popular, other people step in and take care of stuff that needs to be taken care of that somebody else doesn't want to do. And so I'm not surprised, you know. Some people know ahead of time, or they got it in their head ahead of time, that they're going to have to dispatch their own birds. And other people say, no, I'm not doing that. I've got to find somebody who will. So,
all right. Well, let's go back to our listeners. And Jenny's in Keene. Hi, Jenny. Go ahead.
Hi there. Hi. Thanks. We have chickens. And we've had 8 chickens for 2 years, and they're not laying as many. We have them pretty much strictly for the eggs, although they've become my children's pets. And so we decided this spring to get more chickens so that we'd have more eggs. And we're having a hard time introducing the baby chicks to the grown chickens. So I don't know if anyone there has any advice. What we're doing now is we have kind of a pen within a pen, and we have an opening so that the babies can come out if they want, but they can run back in if they're being pecked.
So there's some bullying on the playground there,
Jenny.
Yeah, there
is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling in.
Particular.
Go ahead, Dot.
That's not unusual. Chickens don't like chickens from other flocks. So if you had a broody hen and she hatched out chickens, those eggs that she sat on would be from all of the other chickens in the flock. And so they would accept those baby chickens and not attack them. They would stay with their mother and it would be fine. But when you bring chickens in from the outside, whether they're baby chickens or whether they're adult chickens, the resident flock will kill or try to kill the other birds. With the baby chickens, what she's doing by putting them in a pen within a pen is a really good idea. I, every year, have more baby chickens. And since I hatched out the chicks or I bought the chicks, my resident flock considers them aliens as far as they're concerned. So I usually just keep them penned near the other chickens so that they're constantly talking and they get used to each other, and then eventually open the door so that they can go about 6 weeks of age. I let them run in and out so that they're with the other birds, but they can get away just like she's doing. And by fall, they'll all be integrated, but they will always be segregated. It's interesting. If you bring in four new birds, those four birds will stay together and stay away from the rest of the flock. Whoever was raised together stays together. It's kind of interesting.
How many do you have, Dot?
Right now I've got 9, and I've got 5 baby chickens. Okay. And a rooster. I do have a rooster.
You do have a rooster.
Yes, I do.
And does it wake you up at some ungodly hour in the morning?
He does crow all the time, and I enjoy it. But I don't have neighbors that are close to listen to my rooster, so...
Here's an email from, actually it's a Facebook comment from Cammy. Self-proclaimed bird nuts here. 38 hens, 78 roosters, they're gone. 4 turkeys and a lone rooster. It's been 5 years of fresh eggs, 2 years with fresh, unadulterated, free-range meat, several happy neighbors who purchased eggs, and lots of curious passers-by who check out our chook wagons. Cammy says Loudoun has dozens of families who keep their own birds, and I've yet to hear anyone in town squawk about the chickens next door. So, Cammy, thank you for that story. It's interesting to hear. At what point do you stop being a backyard chicken farmer and you start being a chicken farmer? Take out the backyard. She's got a pretty big operation there.
She does have quite a few. People tend to grow and grow and grow if they love it and they have time for it.
So do the zoning rules and so forth that we talked about earlier with Jason Reimers, does that change when you reach a certain level?
Town by town.
Town by town.
Same thing.
Right. All right. Well, Cammy, good luck to you. That's a great story. You know, Doc, coming up, we're going to be looking more at rules and regulations around composting in your backyard. Can you use chicken droppings for compost?
Oh, sure. It has a lot of calcium in it and phosphorus, but it needs to be composted for a long time. It takes a considerable amount of carbon, meaning a lot of shavings or something, you know, brown matter to be turned into it to get it to break down, and chicken manure is what we call hot, so it burns plants really easily unless it's composted really well.
So you can do it, but maybe consult a professional. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. Final thoughts, Dot, from you on people who may be listening to us and going, wow, I want to do this.
I want them to use common sense. Think about, you know, feces is feces, and you should be washing your hands and what have you. You know, the salmonella problem was the CDC found that all of those people that were infected had those chickens indoors. They were baby chickens, so maybe little kids were touching them, and then nobody was washing their hands and putting your hands in your mouth. And it might look clean, but those eggs are being laid into a nest where feet and they're walking around and whatever, and
so
you know,
hands,
so
wash
your
hands,
use some common sense, check with your neighbors, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Dot. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, an update on new voting rights laws across the country, then getting lost in the digital age, all coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather, we have a flash flood watch in effect through this evening for most of the state. Cloudy showers, chance of thunderstorms for today, some locally heavy rainfall possible, high temperatures in the upper 60s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Currier Museum of Art in Manchester, presenting Romare Bearden, A Black Odyssey, an alternative take on Homer from this talented African-American artist, Currier.org. And Murray & Walker offering technology solutions and network management for businesses. Information on the web at murrayandwalker.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we turn now from backyard chicken farming to the compost heap. Turns out different states have different do's and don'ts about composting, and some people think New Hampshire needs to change. We'll find out more. You can join us with your questions and comments about backyard composting at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange at NHPR.com. nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. It's NHPR Exchange, all one word. We've got lots of pictures of people's backyard chickens, by the way, on our Facebook page. You can post a picture of your compost heap if you would like. Again, it's NHPR Exchange, all one word. With us now to sort out some of this is NHPR's environment reporter, Sam Evans-Brown. And Sam, thanks a lot for taking time out.
Thanks for having me on, Laura.
Well, so whether you compost or not seems to be an individual choice. What's the interest of state and local governments in this issue of composting?
So basically, anyone who's throwing anything away is paying per ton to have it thrown away. And so towns and businesses are paying, and I've seen estimates around $90 a ton is about the average, but it really depends on where you are to have your waste hauled away. So anything you can pull out of the waste stream, if you're doing it for less than you're paying, you're saving yourself money. And also, you know, the landfills are filling up less quickly. You won't have to build landfills as soon. And you might get a resource out of it in the terms of compost that you can then sell back to people who are gardeners and looking to, you know, build soil.
Well, and I definitely want to ask you about that sellback in just a minute. So there's a cost to the individual, Sam, of throwing away, you know, banana peels and coffee grounds. And there's a societal cost because the landfills get filled up and the town and or the city has to pay for that.
And there is a bit of a debate as to how much of a cost that is, because you can, for instance, you can put methane extractors on top of landfills and use that methane to generate electricity or for whatever reason. But in general, you know, it does seem if there's just compost in a landfill that's rotting away, taking up space and emitting methane into the atmosphere, that's not a good solution.
Again, I want to remind listeners that you can join us for the next 15 minutes or so. We'll be talking with Sam Evans-Brown about composting, including a new push to change some of the rules around composting here in the Granite State. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, Sam, I definitely want to ask you about your story that you did on how the rules around composting are being discussed here in New England. But could you just take a few minutes, please, and just describe how composting works?
Right. So
what's the sort of geeky science here?
Yeah. and it's not incredibly complicated. Basically, there are just microbes that are everywhere, and when you start to throw things away, they're breaking things down. And so you get, you know, you have your inputs in, you have your food scraps or your compostables, and you have what are called thermophilic bacteria, which are called that because as they do their work, they produce energy, which then produces heat. And so if you've ever seen a big compost pile as it gets turned by a farmer, you always see steam rising up off of it. That's because these bacteria create this waste heat. And they just do their job and they break things down into whatever it is that they can't break down. That's the compost that's left over, and carbon dioxide and you know, the other nutrients that eventually go back into the soil. And generally, when you talk about commercial composters, there's this sort of Goldilocks zone of hot enough, where the compost pile gets hot enough to kill pathogens so that you don't have, you know, things that you worry about being put into the compost bags that could make people sick, but not so hot that you're killing the bacteria that actually are doing the composting. And this Goldilocks zone, it's about 130 to 150 degrees Fahrenheit. And so you try to just keep things in that zone. And how the big composters do that is if the pile starts to get too hot, they are turning the pile. So they let some air in that slows the reaction down. If it's not hot enough, you put more stuff in. And then the other thing you'll hear a lot about if you get really into composting is the green to brown ratio. And green are things that contain nitrogen, which is one of the components of the reaction, and brown are things that contain carbon. That's the other component.
So it's a science experiment.
Oh, yeah, totally. And it's about a 30-to-1 ratio of what they talk about, green to brown. And if you have too much nitrogen, the pile will start to smell like ammonia. So that's one unpleasant odor that you want to avoid. And then if you have too much carbon, basically it doesn't all break down. So you get incomplete composting. And the last thing you want to watch out for with composting is you don't want to get anaerobic, so not enough oxygen. That's why people turn the piles to introduce oxygen in. If the pile goes anaerobic, you start to get hydrogen sulfide, which is another unpleasant odor. So if you have a stinky compost pile, it's an indication that you're not paying enough attention to it.
Wow. Okay. So you're starting to go where I wanted to go anyway, Sam. So let's go there. Why is it that some people throw just about anything in their compost, you know, whatever it is. And other people get very particular, you could even say fussy, about, you know, what to put in, what not to put in, and when to put it in. Not too many vegetables, the right amount of coffee grounds. No, no, don't put those bananas in there. There's too many bananas. Layering it with leaves. I mean, it's almost like baking a cake. I mean, does it really make a difference for your average backyard composter? I can see on the commercial scale, but...
Yeah, so I would say that if you want perfect compost, if you want something that's basically of the quality that you would get from, you know, going to the store and buying a bag of compost, that's kind of what you have to do. If all you're looking to do is get your food scraps out of your garbage so that your garbage doesn't smell awful in your kitchen, I think that the fussiness is really overrated. You know, we're composters at home. We are not fussy composters. We basically have a heap that we throw things in, and occasionally it smells bad, but, you know, it's in such a place that the neighbors aren't bothered, so it's not a big deal. And so really, that's the fussiness is to avoid a stinky pile and to get good quality compost. And, you know, if it's not perfect quality and you're okay with that, then I just don't worry about it. Just throw the stuff in the heap.
So, and you say throw it in the heap, so you don't have one of those nice plastic boxes.
We do at home. Just because we live right in downtown Concord, and we don't want to be, you know, we don't want to irritate people with something unsightly. But you don't need them. I mean, all you need is something that introduces oxygen, right? So you see a lot of people building them out of pallets or chicken wire, so the oxygen can flow through. Or you can just do a heap and turn it regularly with a pitchfork.
What I always wonder about the heaps is, are you offering snacks to skunks and raccoons and so forth?
You certainly might be. I know, you know, I grew up in a rural area of New Hampshire, and we composted everything. You know, we threw meat scraps and dairy scraps in there all the time. And you know, it's very likely that animals were pillaging that pile frequently, but it was far enough away from the house, and we were out in the middle of nowhere, so it didn't seem to bother anybody. But I think the, you know, this sort of gets at what I think we'll be talking about later, is the idea that you can't compost meat and dairy. What you're really worried about is attracting animals. And you'll attract animals if there's too much meat and dairy. If there's enough that's what they're smelling, as opposed to you've got this gigantic heap of yard clippings and somewhere in there there's a tiny little scrap of meat, you're less likely to attract something.
All right, definitely want to talk to you about that, because that was a big subject in your article, Sam. Let me also remind our listeners that you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. If you've got questions about composting, especially some of the rules and regulations around composting, town by town, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Here's an email that came in from James in Newburyport, who says, "Thanks for doing a compost show. I'm thinking about doing my own composting at home, but I don't want to have a big compost heap in my backyard. Is there a special type of container I could use, and what should I look for?"
So we talked about this a little bit. There are certainly sort of off-the-shelf solutions that you can get that don't look bad. They're just sort of those black containers that you've seen in some people's yards. You might still smell it. We've got one of these at home, and I find it's very difficult to turn the compost when it's in one of these containers.
It's hard to get in there.
Yeah, there are some that you can buy that are on a roller, and you can sort of roll them. But again, that's adding expense to something that perhaps you don't want to spend a lot of money on. If you're really set on not having anything in your backyard, there's vermiculture compost, which are worm containers. And I was actually just talking to one of our producers who's got one of these at his house. You can do those on your closet, and you could do it in New York City, and lots of people do. So look into that if you're really set on not having anything in your yard.
Well, James, thanks for the email. I have a friend who did the wormaculture. Is that what you called it?
Well, vermiculture.
Vermiculture. Yeah. underneath the sink in her kitchen,
yeah.
Where, you know,
just
you
need
would
a dark
put the
spot
trash bag.
Because they don't like light.
Right. Well, and maybe that's what happened with us, because a neighbor of ours moved and handed over his vermiculture to us, and we killed them. Sorry to admit that on the air. So maybe we did something wrong there. Here's another email from Alex, who says, "My landlord allows me to compost behind my apartment building. We share a garden with one of our neighbors, and we've caught some of the other tenants who don't use the garden adding to the compost. I built my own using spare pallets. So, Alex, thank you very much. So even people in apartment buildings are doing this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, again, we're right in downtown Concord. Well, not downtown, but we're in Concord. And we have a couple neighbors who have asked if they can put stuff on our pile because they don't have space of their own. And you know, we're happy to provide that service and are able to get compost out of it in the end that we can put on our garden.
So even if you're not a gardener, give it to the person next door.
And I will tell this to people who ask me about composting. One of the things that I like most about doing it, you know, the whole sort of environmental arguments aside, is that your garbage doesn't stink. You can leave your garbage for weeks on end because there's nothing in there that's rotting away, and it won't start to smell bad.
The thing I like about it is I hate going out to the compost pile and adding stuff because the flies fly up in my face and yuck. But it's also a little less guilty for me to clean out those rotting vegetables in the bottom of the vegetable drawer if I know I'm going to compost them. So it wasn't a total waste
right.
that I forgot to cook them up. And
yeah, it'll become soil. It'll become a resource again.
Right. All right. Let's go to our callers, Sam. And Stephen's calling from Cape Neddick, Maine. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I have a compost pile, but I also weed my garden, and I don't put the weeds in the compost pile because they'll just come back. So is there any method by which you can compost weeds and get the temperature hot enough so that it kills the weed seeds? I've done some research, and I guess you have to get them up to around 140. And I tried one method, which was to put them in black garbage bags and keep them out in the sun.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I put a data recorder in that, and the highest it gets is like 124, and I didn't know if anybody knew of any sort of solar oven or something that you could do to cook it, and then because then you've still got the organic material that could go back in the garden without.
Sure. You know, Stephen, this is a great question. Actually, people talk about putting yard waste, grass clippings, but there's seeds in there, and you could be, you know, creating some trouble for yourself.
And so Stephen is exactly right, and the way you deal with this is to make it hot. And the way you make it hot is unfortunately, it's more compost. And so for a lot of backyard composters, the size of a pile you need in order to get it hot enough to kill weed seeds is really prohibitive. You just don't generate enough waste to create a pile big enough to get that kind of heat. And that's why, you know, commercial composters, if you've seen any of the commercial outfits, they've got huge windrows that are turned by tractors. Some of them will have augers inside the windrow that turns it automatically. They've got aerator pipes in the base that are pumping up air into it to keep everything at the right temperature. So if you want those temperatures, it really becomes a much more complicated endeavor. So for someone like Stephen, if you're really dedicated to this, if you've got the space, try to find source of more organic material from your neighbors, from your friends, from restaurants maybe, that you can get a big enough pile. But it becomes much, you know, you're no longer just chucking your scraps into a pile in the backyard. You're really becoming a composter.
Well, thanks a lot for that call, Stephen. It's a good question. Here's one from Alan in Nashua who says, why can't you mix milk and meat in compost piles? You touched on this earlier, Sam, but let's talk about this in a little more detail because this has been a controversial issue.
So, controversial is probably too strong a word. There are not a huge number of actors worried about it, but basically, in New Hampshire, you're not allowed to compost milk and meat. It's not a law. It is a rule. It was written as they were writing the DES was writing the rules for who can throw what away and what permits are required to throw what away. And basically, the permit that most composters are applying for doesn't allow meat and dairy because they're concerned about pathogens. They're concerned that you're going to have rotting meat that's going to partially decompose and not get completely decomposed, and then vectors. So you're going to have rodents or seagulls or what have you, bears, get into the compost pile and pull that partially rotted meat out, and then you're going to have some sort of health risk.
Wow, that's pretty complicated.
Yeah. So, and I think what you would hear composters in New Hampshire say is that the states all around us, Vermont, Maine, Massachusetts, do allow the composting of meat and dairy, and it's really not that complicated. As I alluded to before, you just have to make sure that you're not putting too much of these, of these types of scraps into your pile, so they're dilute enough that they're not creating this, you know, incredible allure for animals, and that, you know, you're covering the piles, you're keeping it so that animals can't get in. And it can be done safely. So they are the composters, of which there are, you know, a half dozen in the state.
These are commercial composters.
Commercial composters are pushing for this change because they say it's a big stumbling block for them to be able to expand their business, because the big food wasters, as they call them, are the ones who are the bedrock of their business. So hospitals, restaurants, and if you've got to pick meat and dairy scraps off the plate, those people are not going to sign up to have to pay to have their food waste hauled away. It's just adding another headache for them.
So this is a big economic opportunity that we're not taking advantage of. That's their perspective anyway.
Yeah, and if you look at what's happening around us, I mean, Massachusetts has as of October, will make it illegal for large food wasters to throw food scraps into landfills, so they're going to be required to compost. In Vermont, by 2020, they're going to phase out any food scraps in landfills, period, from anyone. So
food meaning meat, dairy, the whole thing.
Yeah, the whole thing. So basically, New Hampshire businesses are saying, hey, New Hampshire doesn't even have to do anything. We don't have to say anything, but we could, for example, be hauling away compost from Massachusetts companies if only New Hampshire would change these rules so that we could take advantage of this opportunity.
Wow, that's really interesting. And as you know, Sam, you know, every year in the legislature, up to 1,000 bills or even more are sometimes proposed or submitted. Not all of them obviously get to the final hearing. Do you think there's going to be a proposal about easing up on these compost rules so that, you know, people can take advantage of this?
I think it actually probably won't require that because as I mentioned, this is not a law. It is a rule that
Got
was set.
It.
So laws were written about waste disposal, and then you send those to the bureaucracy, and the bureaucracy writes the rules, the really nitty-gritty stuff. And so I think the DES can change this rule through its normal rulemaking procedures without having to have a law.
Okay. Sam, thank you very much. Real interesting stuff.
Anytime.
Sam Evans Brown, environment reporter for us here at NHPR. You can go to our Facebook page to continue the conversation. We actually had someone who called in, couldn't get on the air, who had an answer to Stephen's question about cooking those weed seeds. So go to our Facebook page, continue the conversation there. And while you're there at NHPR Exchange, enjoy those lovely pictures of chickens that people posted. That's NHPR Exchange. All one word. The Exchange is a production of NHPR, and today we say a fond farewell to our wonderful volunteer, Alan Cohen. Alan, good luck on this next phase in your life. I'm Laura Canoy. Auntie Brenda's mobile phone are all converted into loam. Cause I can compost anything in my marvelous compost bin. I can compost anything in my voodoo compost bin. Compost anything in my mysterious compost bin. I can compost anything in my marvelous compost bin.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Canoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, a new verdict on violent video games. A study from Dartmouth suggests teens who play certain games are more likely to develop what one researcher calls a warped moral compass, but others argue singling out one form of entertainment is oversimplified and ignores other factors. We'll find out more, and then an update on the Market Basket saga. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare, a sustainable system improving the health of our communities for generations to come. Imagine.d-h.org. And Comcast Business continuously investing to keep customers ahead of the technology curve. Comcast Business is built for business. More at business.comcast.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVU Concord.
89.1. WEVS Nashua.
88.3. WEVH Hanover.
91.3. WEVN Keene.
90.7. WEVC Gorham.
107.1. WEVJ Jackson.
99.5. WEVF Colebrook.
90.3. And WEVQ Littleton.
91.9. And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act required states with a history of discrimination to get pre-clearance from the government before changing voting laws. Last year, the Supreme Court struck down key provisions of the act, including Section 5. Since then, 22 states have passed laws restricting voting rights. Some require photo ID or proof of citizenship. Others are cutting back on early voting days or eliminating polling places. And last week, a federal judge rejected a challenge to North Carolina's new voting laws, widely considered the most restrictive in the nation. An update on voting rights around the country calls for congressional action. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The National Weather Service says parts of Long Island, New York, have gotten a staggering amount of rain this morning. The service says some areas got more than 10 inches of rain in just a few hours. Local media are showing cars submerged